I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. With a near-record field of candidates, anyone running for governor in Kansas has their work cut out for them just to get noticed. One of them is Democrat Carl Brewer. The former mayor of Wichita has a broad platform, including what should be done regarding education, the economy, and health care access. Today we'll get his views on those issues as we continue our series introducing you to the candidates. Then we look at what the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department is doing when a call involves someone dealing with a mental health crisis. Hear how officers are working to get people connected to the resources they need rather than take them to jail. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Former Wichita Mayor Carl Brewer is making a determined run for Kansas governor as one of three leading Democratic candidates in the field. And what a field it is. The Associated Press just reported that with a field of 15 candidates, the number of contenders is the second highest in state history. The record, 16, set in 1964. Brewer is emphasizing restoring education funding and providing health care access as he makes his way across the state. Carl Brewer is a former member of the Kansas National Guard, and he worked for Boeing, Spirit AeroSystems, and Cessna as a manufacturing engineer and manager. He was the mayor of Wichita from 2007 to 2015. The primary election is in August. Carl Brewer joins us now from Wichita. And Carl, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you? Thank you for having me on.
You bet. Our pleasure, Carl. And as I just mentioned, this is the second largest gubernatorial field in state history. How hard is it to, you know, to break through in a field this large and get the attention you need to win a primary race?
Well, certainly I recognize that, you know, it's just about getting out there, visiting individuals, visiting communities, talking to individuals, and getting them an opportunity to be able to meet you. And I think that's one of the great advantages that we actually have in today's social media, which was basically what they did many years ago. But in today's environment with social media, they don't necessarily have to do that. You see a lot of them, they're planning on doing advertisement and things of that nature, and that's how they plan on getting their message. But I'm a firm believer, because I was a former mayor, that people like to get an opportunity to meet the person that's running for office, that's going to be representing them. So you're not sending a message just one way. There's an opportunity for them to question you and ask you information. So it's been going really great. You know, I've traveled over this entire state, and I've back and forth in western Kansas, northeastern Kansas, northeast, south, and west. And I tell you, it's just been really exciting.
You know, you were a mayor. How good a stepping stone to the state's top job is being mayor of Wichita?
Well, certainly, you know, you have to figure out some of the legislation, how the legislation works. But I was with I was president of the Kansas League of Municipalities, which represented all the cities in the state of Kansas. And so I had an opportunity to spend a lot of time with the state legislators and understanding how their process actually work. But I think the one advantage that I actually have is from being the mayor is that I know when bad decisions affect communities that you know, as mayor, you find out immediately. I mean, you have to address the issue with Mr. or Mrs. Jones or with children that are in schools on bad decisions that have actually been made. But not only that, you know, here in Wichita, you know, I've been an individual that's been able to be able to work with individuals that were Republican, Independent, Democrat, work with all of these individuals and bringing everyone to the table.
Right.
So, I think it's been very beneficial.
Carl Brewer is my guest. You want to be the next governor of Kansas, Carl. Why?
Well, certainly I've seen some of the things that have actually happened here in the state of Kansas. I've had to represent other cities, had to represent Wichita, and there's just been bad legislation policy that have went on that have affected individuals, whether it be health care, whether it be homelessness, whether it be senior citizens, cutting funding for education. And the underserved, those that don't have a voice, will not have a voice. And in fact, there are big pushes to be able to create more of an environment like that. And so my thing is I want to give individuals an opportunity to have a voice and have inclusion and everyone have an opportunity to be at the table. And when we start talking about economic development and growing our communities, growing businesses in our community, we must teach everyone how to do that. And then secondly, help them as opposed to dictating to them how communities will grow. You know, I've seen legislation that has been passed where in communities and cities, you know, they have to maintain bridges, they have to maintain roads, and they have to maintain education. But then the state, they put policies in place that tie their hands. So how do you expect them to be successful if you're going to tie their hands and they have to come to you to get permission to be able to function? And our state legislators, they're only there for 90 days out of the year during legislative session, is what it's supposed to be, unless they have an extended one. And, you know, these things affect individuals' lives and our families and our communities and senior citizens and our children each and every day. Even when a bad decision is made, it still affects our families and our communities each and every day. And when those types of things happen, they must be fixed immediately.
Right.
Not Carol, putting them off to another legislative session.
Carol, during the two terms you were mayor of Wichita, what would you cite as your single, and I underline the word single, your single proudest achievement?
I would say my single proudest achievement was to be able to get individuals to put aside their differences and come to the table and identify what was in the best interest of all citizens, everyone in the community, whether it was corporate America or whether it was Mr. and Mrs. Jones that were senior citizens that retired, or whether it was high school kids or elementary school kids, and making sure that their issues and their concerns were our top priorities, and those are the issues that we worked on. And we were successful at being able to do that. During the worst recession in the history of this country, we were successful.
You would be the state's first African-American governor if you are elected in November. How significant is race in this campaign?
Well, you know, I look at it as Kansans want a person that's certainly qualified and capable of being able to do it. But in some communities that have been denied an opportunity to have a voice or been denied various different things or feel that they have been left behind, it's important to them to be able to have someone that certainly looked very similar to them, because certainly it'd be difficult for someone to say, well, I don't understand, because I clearly understand. You know, I come from very humble beginnings, and so I understand the challenges that they actually have, and I understand about not having an opportunity to have a voice. And so they recognize that this person's going to be able to provide that for them.
How far did Governor Sam Brownback set back Kansas during his 7 years as governor, Carl?
Well, I would have to tell you that it was from day one when he made the horrible tax decisions that he made and implementing those. Because when you start looking at the state of Kansas, you know, we're focused on the foundation of manufacturing, agriculture, and property taxes. And when you know, we all know that just basic principles, you have to have a certain amount of revenue coming in. And when you decide that you're going to give individuals the opportunity to not pay the revenue, then that means it has to come from someplace. And if you don't come up with a strategy and a plan before you implement that, there are going to be shortages. And so he never did that. So he set us back approximately 7 years. It was a tax structure, and then there were other bad decisions. You know, when we start talking about health care, he turned back approximately $2.7 billion. Not that it made any sense.
To expand Medicaid, you're talking about.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been used to help senior citizens. It could have been used to help children. But he sent it back because he didn't believe in it. And so it was sent to other states throughout the United States. And so we have a lot of people here that need health care. We have a lot of people that have a lot of needs. And that could have been very helpful to us.
You know, one of the biggest issues right now facing the state is school funding, as you well know. The Kansas Supreme Court is reviewing what the legislature did this session when lawmakers approved a $525 million increase in school spending over 5 years. Do you believe that was enough money? Should the court be satisfied with that, Carl?
I have continuously went across this entire state, and I don't, you know, rural Kansas, urban Kansas, and education funding has been a real issue to them. And so, you know, there was an independent group that came out and they said that we should pay like $1.7 to $2 billion is what we should be paying. And And of course, our state legislators were appalled at that and didn't think it was correct. But in actuality, if you start looking at when they started cutting education funding, that is what we actually owe. We owe that just to even come close to breaking even. But then we must come up with a strategy and a plan on where we're going to be for the next 5 to 10 years, because the cost of living isn't going down. It's continuously increasing. So what's the strategy to plan and projected numbers there? And we need to have a plan on how we're going to come up with that.
So do you advocate a $2 billion increase in school spending then?
Certainly I do. And we need to tell public and citizens exactly where we're going to come up with that particular dollar figure, because they're wanting to spend that $500 million expanded and extended over a 3-year time frame.
Well, where do you come up with $2 billion then?
Well, certainly we're going to have to come up with a different tax structure than we actually have today and identify what it is we actually need and then come up with a different tax structure. We have to diversify our economy and start bringing in other things and selling the goods that we actually have, whether it's manufacturing, whether it's agriculture. We certainly need to diversify, start looking at clean energy, new technology. Those are the types of things that give us additional revenue to be able to support paying for funding.
But certainly tax increases would be on the table in a Carl Brewer administration then.
Well, you certainly have to look at it, but you know it would be the last resource of you being able to do that. When we start, we've had individuals come in that were independent that start looking at us during the recession, what we actually needed. And they identified that when businesses started talking about expanding or where their future growth is going to be, they look at, do they have a skilled workforce, educated workforce? What are the schools like? What's crime like? What are the communities like? Well, education should be as equally important as water in our communities. But in Kansas, it's not. Hmm. It has been put on the back burner, and well, we'll get around to it. And that's not fair to the children here in the state of Kansas, because we're sending them out to go and compete with the rest of the world.
Hmm.
It's no longer that they're competing with the states to the north, east, south, and west of it. They're competing with the rest of the world at those opportunities to have those good jobs, those good quality of lives. And if we create where we have a good educational system here in the state of Kansas, businesses and those new opportunities to come here, I firmly believe that we need to take a serious look at what Colorado and some of the other states are doing when we start looking at the legalization of marijuana. And
you've advocated that before, I believe. Is that right?
Beg your pardon?
You've advocated for that.
Yes, I have. If you start looking at what they're actually doing, that's additional revenue in the hundreds of millions of dollars that we can actually use for education and we can use for health care.
How about sports gambling, Carl?
I think we need to take a serious look at it, but I don't believe that it's healthy for us to be able to allow them to gamble on, or here in the state of Kansas, to gamble on high school games and things of that nature. Because, as you know, individuals want to push the envelope, you know, and so certainly there are some opportunities where individuals can get involved in it, and then we can skew the votes and skew the numbers and things of that nature as far as, you know, athletes playing. But I don't see where there's a real problem as far as individuals out there gambling.
You know, as you look at the curriculum that Kansas students go through in grades K through 12, how satisfied are you with what kids are learning these days, or does the curriculum need to be examined and perhaps overhauled?
Well, the curriculum certainly needs to be examined, and we certainly need to overhaul it. I think we have some teachers that are doing fabulous jobs that are actually there, but there's some real demands on them. You know, you're talking about a guy. You know, I have 13 grandchildren, and 10 of them go to school here in Wichita, and they're in public schools. And so I understand, and I'm continuously talking to them about what's going on in school. Do you know these types of things? And I'm amazed at some of the things that they don't know. So we certainly need to do some things and overhaul that. And I've met children in other countries that do very well. And I recognize that the children here in Wichita and those that are in Kansas would have a difficult time competing with them, because in some of these other countries, education is a top priority, and they don't hesitate in investing in it.
If our listeners want to join our conversation, we have Carl just for a few more minutes. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. Carl Brewer, a former mayor of Wichita, is on the phone with us today. He's a candidate for the Democratic nomination for Kansas governor. I think you've already alluded to this, Carl. When it comes to Medicaid expansion, you are all for it. Do I have that right?
I am all for it. And you know, I see where there's individuals inside our communities that, you know, that need that type of help, and so we need to provide them with that. And they've done well for our community, for our state of Kansas. They worked extremely hard for them, but sometimes things happen, and so we need to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to have health care. That's just the right thing to do as a leader.
You know, Governor Collier, the new governor who succeeded Governor Brownback, has been pushing for a requirement that welfare recipients in Kansas work to receive those benefits. If they're going to get the benefits, they have to work to do it. Is that a good idea in your view?
Well, I see nothing wrong with it, but the question is how are they going to work to get it?
Mm-hmm.
What is the strategy and what is the plan to be able to have individuals to work to do it? And if they're going to say, well, if you can't work, then you're not going to get it. Not everyone can work. There are individuals with mental disabilities. There are individuals with physical disabilities. I mean, you have to use common sense when you put those types of things in place.
Some parents child care to worry about. Some parents have jobs exactly. That may not give them enough hours to reach the requirement. There's lots of problems there, I think. Yeah.
Exactly. And so sometimes the individuals, I'll just say it like it is. They dream up these ideas, and they haven't given it a lot of thought. And if this was a great plan, and it was a great thought, then when he was the lieutenant governor, why didn't he speak up and say that then?
You know, the caring of
we've had 7 years that we could have analyzed it, we could have figured it out, and we could have done something of this nature. So.
The carrying of concealed guns is allowed on college campuses in Kansas these days. Should they be?
No. We don't allow them in our schools, and we certainly should not allow them. And so certainly it doesn't need to be on college campuses. We send our children there to get an education. We have professors that are there to educate individuals. So that's what we want to put that focus on, and not carrying weapons on college campuses, because all of us know, and I have seen as mayor, how weapons have managed to get away from the person that had it or was responsible for it. We've even had at the state legislation where individuals went off and left a weapon in their desk there on the floor. So bringing something like that into an environment where we have young people and young minds, young students, let's let the college professors focus on educating them and allow the children to get an opportunity to get an education.
Carl, speaking of guns, Republican gubernatorial candidate Chris Kobach just rolled through a parade in Johnson County last weekend in a Jeep next to a replica 50-caliber machine gun. What did you make of it?
Well, as you know, I served 21 years in the military, and I commanded infantry and armored soldiers, preparing them to go to combat. And so I tried to look at the picture to see exactly what type of weapon that was, but it didn't look like any of those. I saw the back portion look like a 50 caliber. But the thing is it's inappropriate, and particularly when you're talking about a day in an environment like we have today, that's something that's inappropriate. And you saw me. I posted a picture of a person that has served in the military that clearly understand M16s, M50s. And, you know, there's a time and there's a place, and those things are used for certain things, and those are primarily to defend our country. And that was... it wasn't appropriate, it was inappropriate, and he certainly should have been, with all the shootings that have happened in schools, should have been sensitive to that. But those are things that are just plain, simple common sense. And in this particular case, none was used.
David from Bonner Springs. David, you're on with Democrat Carl Brewer. He's a candidate for Kansas governor. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Good morning.
Mr. Brewer, the Kansas City Star had a significant series of articles in the not-too-distant past about the problems in the foster care system and how certain agencies were losing track of children in foster care, and that was tied into the question of secrecy within the Kansas government. The question I have for you is, do you feel at the moment that this problem has been resolved? If your answer is no, what are you considering as to confront the problem?
I think David's referring to children being left in foster care offices to spend the night on occasion when there's no placements that can be found. And sometimes, in other cases, the state can't keep track of all the foster kids and where they are right now. Carl, how would you address it?
Well, to answer your question, you know, no, the state of Kansas has not done a very good job. In fact, they've done an absolute horrible job. If there was a grade that you could actually give as far as how we've actually done that, it would be an F that I would give them. And what we have to do is we have to start figuring out how we're going to really truly address the system, because of the fact that when the state actually take these children and we have them, what we're telling individuals is that we can do a better job of raising your children and taking care of your children than you can. And so, and for us to lose 73 children and we don't have the slightest clue where they're at, that's unacceptable. And we can certainly need to create an environment where we have more transparency. Whether these children are our biological children or the children that live in our neighborhood or children that live in our state, they're still our children, and we owe it to them that we're going to create a safe environment for them, and it's going to be a better environment. And we have to have trained and skilled individuals that are in particular jobs that do this. Now, we have to start with it from law enforcement. Certainly, we have to start with DCF is one of the areas that we have to work on, and all the other agencies, but we have to connect it and come up with a clear process on how we address issues and even connecting it to schools. If children that we've taken out and we put them in foster care, if they don't show up to school, then we should have a process in place that identifies this child didn't come to school, and individuals start looking, figuring out where is this child at.
All right. Lynn from Lenexa. Lynn, you're on Up to Date with Carl Brewer. Good morning.
Yes, Mr. Brewer. In the Blue Valley and Olathe school districts, the facilities that education takes place in are incredibly outstanding. I mean, they're just dynamite. And compared to what exists in Kansas City, Kansas, and in rural districts I'm aware of, where does that money come from that is building those gorgeous facilities? And yet we don't seem to have money in education. Is that all from tax dollars? Or, you know, how can we equalize education to all?
I was going to say, Carl, speak to the disparities between rich city schools and poor rural ones. I think that's what Lynn's asking about here.
Yes, that's it. And the thing is that a lot of it has to do with the amount of that individuals. Some of it come from private school, from private donors. Major corporations, private schools of that nature, because in the city of Wichita, we have that exact same thing where a lot of the private schools do very well because private donors, churches, things of that nature. And then when you start talking about impoverished communities, they don't receive that. And so we have to come up with a fair and equitable way as to how we're going to actually distribute those dollars and get them out there. And when I say those dollars, I mean the tax dollars themselves, because from the private sector, you can't direct them to where they're going to put their dollars at.
Right.
But we do that, but we also have to make sure that you take rural Kansas. We need to make sure that these are the standards and this is the level of education that we need to make sure that those individuals have, and give them the power to determine whether or not that they want to keep their schools open or not. But
we're going to have to leave her. We're going to leave our conversation there, Carl. I'm running out of time, okay. But that's Carl Brewer, Democratic candidate for the nomination for Kansas governor. Carl, thanks so much for taking some time, and travel safe out there, okay?
Thank you. We're enjoying it, and I look forward to meeting more of the Kansans as we travel this in state.
Sounds good. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to switch topics dramatically, and we're going to talk about mental health and how police deal with those kinds of issues when they encounter them on the street. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, Jason Kander was here. He discussed a possible bid for the presidency in 2020 and told us how he's battling voter suppression in the meantime. You can hear that conversation and many others at kcur.org/up to date. Tomorrow, renovations are in store for some iconic Kansas City buildings, including much of the block facing the Barney Ellis Plaza. We'll take a look at some downtown developments tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, according to one estimate, nearly a third of all 911 calls involve some type of mental health crisis. Law enforcement in this country is taking steps to grapple more directly with this reality with new programs and new approaches, including some right here in Kansas City that have received national attention. Today, a look at services that are available to help people with substance abuse and mental health issues who come in contact with police and the criminal justice system. With us are Sergeant Sean Hess. He's a 27-year member of the Kansas City Police Department, and he helped create the Crisis Intervention Team. Sergeant, nice to have you. Good morning. Lauren Moyers with Rediscover. That's a nonprofit community mental health center that provides comprehensive services for men, women, and children whose lives have been affected by mental illness or substance use disorders. Lauren, nice to have you too. Good morning.
Good morning.
Sergeant Hess, you've worked in recent years to create something called the Crisis Intervention Team. What is that?
Well, basically, in a nutshell, it's 40 hours of specialized training for law enforcement officers on how to better interact with somebody in a mental health crisis situation. You learn overview of mental illness, how to identify somebody maybe in a mental health crisis situation, medications, and most importantly, I think, how to de-escalate somebody differently from what you were taught in the academy on most regular situations, and finding resources and treatment for them instead of jail.
So this is a training program for the officers on the force right now?
Yes, sir.
How many officers have taken advantage of this?
For Kansas City, about 40%. It's a voluntary program.
And this has been pushed by the chief in the past, right?
Yes, sir. Very much so.
What sorts of calls do you respond to, and what are some of the issues that you guys see out in the streets these days?
You know, all kinds of different calls that involve somebody in a mental health crisis situation. You know, it's anywhere between 25 to 35% of our calls for service load have somebody that has a mental health condition or are in crisis with that. It could be anywhere from a check the welfare of a suicidal party to a suspicious party talking to themselves at a bus station. Whatever you could think of, it could involve mental illness. We've had people that report burglaries that didn't happen because they're in some deep psychosis and delusions. So just almost it encompasses almost anything that you have that we respond on.
Sergeant, what's your sense in the 27 years you've been on the force? To what extent has the department evolved in terms of sensitivities towards folks who are really struggling out there?
When I first started, it was pretty rare to go on these type of calls, you know, and the ones you did go on, you had a place to take them and treatment, and it was done. And now, you know, within the last 10 years, our involvement has you know, not only doubled, but probably quadrupled on our contacts and stuff like that.
You're coming across more people who suffer from mental health
more
out there?
People. And, you know, it's the failings of the mental health system are pretty well known. The lack of resources, financing, funding, and availability. And it's kind of forced police that, you know, from a non-traditional standpoint, we're doing more and more with the mental ill that we never before, you know, and we're having to learn how to adjust and to adapt with it because that is not an easy population to handle a lot of these type of calls.
Lauren, I'm wondering how Rediscover fits into all this and what do you people have to offer here?
Yeah, so we have an array of services as far as crisis intervention comes to play. More recently, we opened up the Kansas City Assessment and Triage Center in October of 2016, and that's really more for the whole community. So it's not just Rediscover, but it's open 24/7, 365, and it's an alternative to jail. It's an alternative to a hospital emergency department, and it's really a place where folks can, like Sergeant Hess, bring those calls that they go and interact with in their home or in the community and bring them to a place where they're going to get triage, they're going to get support, they're going to get medication, and they're going to get linkage to actual outpatient care.
Hey, how many outlets are there for Rediscover around the community?
For that specific Kansas City Assessment and Triage Center, it's open 24/7, 365, and we can have 18 people at any given time. Now, for Rediscover itself, we service the Kansas City metropolitan area. So we have about 16 different locations.
16 now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes.
And these are all places where police officers on the street can bring people who are struggling with a mental health crisis.
So more specifically, we have about two specific locations that are located in South Kansas City and then the Lee Summit area, where police officers could drop folks during the business hours of the Monday through Friday. The Kansas City Assessment and Triage Center, however, is unique in that it's the only location that's open 24/7, 365 for the police to come in, drop off, and actually get a solid intervention. Rather than seeing that individual back out on the street because they didn't get admitted to the hospital in, 2 hours.
So how often are your centers full?
If
it's 2 a.m. and an officer wants to bring someone to you, are they sometimes turned away because you're simply at capacity?
We prioritize for the police first and the hospitals second. And there's only been a handful of times that we have had where we were at capacity and we had to divert them to some other resource. However, we will still triage that situation. So if an officer came in the middle of the night, we would assess the situation with the individual, get them linked to a transitional living or a homeless shelter, or help get them medications filled. So we would still provide them something rather than nothing.
So you guys are really all about trying to avoid taking someone who's suffering from mental illness to the emergency room because those emergency rooms are so costly. This is an alternative that's geared for officers like Sergeant Hess here when they're looking for help.
Absolutely. It's less costly and it's likely more of a useful intervention. A lot of times when people go to the emergency department, they may not be admitted. They're handed a script that they then lose, or they don't have sufficient funds to even fill. So with the Kansas City Assessment and Triage Center, we're able to have flexible funding from the state of Missouri to actually meet the basic needs of the individuals walking through our front door.
How long have you guys been around?
Yeah. So Rediscover has been around 49 years. The Kansas City Assessment and Triage Center, so a new program that we operated, has only been around a year and a half.
So this is a fairly new service.
Absolutely.
The 24 hours a day, 365 days a year is a fairly new development here.
Yes. Now, the other alternative that we've had prior to that, and we still currently have, are for folks that maybe need what we call a mobile assessment. So let's say we didn't have the KCATC and an officer is responding to someone's home, and they really just need help assessing the situation a little further to avoid going to the hospital or avoid going to jail. We have what's called 24-hour crisis intervention teams on the mental health side. So we are actually able to send out a qualified mental health professional to assess the situation.
And that service has been around longer, you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah. How big a development is this new assessment center that Lauren was just describing, Sergeant, that's a year and a half old? How big a deal is this for the police on the street?
It's huge. It really puts a front door for us on to bring somebody in a mental health crisis situation. Like you hit on earlier, ERs are just not the appropriate place. Hospitals, and you start getting that revolving door of taking somebody to the hospital, tying up police, ambulance, fire, the ER staff, and it's been great. We've got people in the services I never thought we would, housing, follow-up. And what it does is it takes them out of the criminal justice alley and puts them into the mental health and gets them into the treatment that they need. And it's been very beneficial for us.
Should someone who's suffering from mental illness, Lauren, should they be in the criminal justice system and they commit a crime while they are suffering a bipolar crisis or a schizophrenic crisis of one kind or another? Do those folks have any business being in the criminal justice system?
The majority, absolutely not. We have a lot of folks.
But that's where we've been in this country for decades, though, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Why is it taking us so long to get here?
I think it goes back to stigma and education. A lot of times people are reluctant to share their experience, to share their struggles, just because of the stigma that goes with that. As a society, I think that it's hard to accept, that we've evolved and everyone's going to have these multitude of issues, just like someone who has diabetes. I mean, society says take your medication, that's supported. we're just kind of evolving into a society that says, you know, make sure take your mood stabilizer for your bipolar. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not a typical response from society. And I think that we're slowly getting there, but we have a lot of education and a lot of just acceptance.
You know, Sergeant, I can only imagine someone out there who's suffering from a bipolar crisis, maybe is in mania, and that person commits a crime and is taken to the Jackson County Detention Center. That isn't going to work.
No, and it's around, between on the stats you look at, 30 to 40% of all people that are incarcerated have some type of mental health issue, illness, and stuff like that. They're not getting any treatment in jail. And then when they get back out, it's not a surprise that they're right back into police contact again.
Even worse off, I imagine.
Yeah, it's a revolving door. Yeah, they may lose a job or the family or support system, housing, and then they're back out in the streets. The police should not be the first contact with this population, but unfortunately, with the cuts and stuff, that's where we're at today.
We're talking this morning about how police deal with folks who are suffering from mental health when they encounter them on the street. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Lauren, let's turn this conversation to some of the real people you've helped over the years, you and your organization, because I'm told you've got lots of stories here. One is about a man that Rediscover helped who wanted to be a chef. Tell us about him.
Yes. So we had a gentleman who had a pretty lengthy history of incarceration at the federal prison level. He was brought to the Kansas City Assessment and Triage Center in the middle of the night with no hope, no hope. He was ready to die. He had no goals, no desire, no motivation to move forward. He was struggling with some bipolar issues as well as substance use from self-medicating for many, many years. We allowed him to sleep, get some rest, take a shower, get some food, a change of clothes, because a lot of times when you focus on that basic need first, instead of trying to push what we feel he needed, it really helps you gain that respect and build that rapport. So after a few hours of sleeping, we were able to have an open conversation of, you know, what does your happy life look like? You know, what is it that you want to get back? He had lost his girlfriend. He had lost any type of supports. All of his family was gone. We did find through further assessment that he did have a background in culinary aspect. He was driven by that. He enjoyed that. When he was doing well, he was doing things like that. We were able to help support him to get him a few more classes with the culinary aspect. And we were able to place him in transitional housing, get him on some medication, go through a substance use program. And in little as 7 months, he obtained a job as a sous chef at a local hotel.
Wow.
Making $60,000 a year, had his own benefits, actually was starting to rekindle his relationship with his girlfriend, and said, You gave me hope. I don't want to die anymore.
Sergeant, you're nodding your head as she's speaking. Do you know who she's talking about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and we have many successful stories just like that, that you bring somebody in that has no hope, has no house. I mean, and she hits it right on the head. If you give them some of that basic necessities and approach at that angle, the chances of them being successful and getting back on meds are a lot better.
How are judges and others who tend to be brought into this system at some point when a person suffering from a mental health crisis commits a crime, how are they reacting? Are you seeing changes there, Sergeant?
Yeah, Judge LaCasio of the municipal court was just a big proponent of this and was really involved in spearheading this from the get-go. And mental health court and vet court are two of the things that we started at a city level in Kansas City. And now
we actually have a mental health court that is just set aside for folks who are struggling with these issues.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And it's great. And that's what we're trying to do, is keep them out of the criminal justice system. So, and that's a big part of the mental health court is to get them into treatment, to get them in compliant with that, get them back into the services, and then try to get them out of the criminal justice side so their records are expunged and stuff like that so they can get a job and be successful.
And we're moving down that road right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your training like when you sit down with officers and walk through this as part of your crisis intervention team? What do you focus on?
You know, there's so much. It's a lot. It's a long week, a 40-hour training.
Wow.
And, you know, it's really, I say it's called training, but it's really sometimes changing the mindset of somebody. It's throwing in that empathy piece. It's talking about the stigma that goes along with the mental illness. And hopefully at the end of that week, they have a whole different understanding. I don't like to just say it's training because I think you change your mindset a bit about it, that these people are the same as us and that they shouldn't be looked at, you know, differently. And, you know, a couple different breaks in life and anybody could be in these type of situations.
That's a hard thing to try to teach, empathy, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's not something you could teach somebody. It's just something that they comes about throughout the week. And you could see that from the first day of training to, you know, starting on Monday, people have, you know, their arms crossed, so maybe a little, you know, I don't really want to be here until a Friday where they've totally accepted the training and come back and say, hey, this is some of the best stuff I've had. I'm waiting to use it on the streets. It's really good.
What difference have you seen in attitudes in the police force, Lauren, as you've gone about your work?
Like Sean said, you know, they're the first responders. And the more that we can collaborate with one another, the easier it will be on us, the people that we serve. So when we do have to call to do an emergency assessment or have that co-partner, you know, we see a huge difference whenever it's somebody that's had that CIT training as opposed to not. And it's just so much more collaborative. We get to the end result much quicker. We don't escalate. You know, the situation isn't escalated. We tend to not have to use the hospital route. So it's been a very beneficial and supported partnership.
You know, for some officers in some situations, I assume, Sergeant, this can be pretty scary stuff, can it?
Oh, yeah.
Confronting someone who's in the middle of a crisis and they're acting strangely, and that's hard stuff.
It's all an unknown, even if you've done the same situation or even know the same person. Each situation's unique, and it can be very scary and not knowing exactly what you need to do for them.
What's been the impact on the crime rate since this work has begun?
You know, it's really, I think, affected it positively, especially our calls for service. We get these folks that are out of the criminal justice side back into the mental health side, and you start seeing the calls go down, the repeat calls, and I think you see the crime rate go down along with it. You know, like the drinking in public, the urination, the shoplifting, stuff like that, if you could get them into the services.
How often do people call specifically and request a CIT officer, a crisis intervention trained officer?
I don't know the exact numbers, but we do train the dispatchers and call takers, and they will tell us all the time that, you know, the public is aware of this program. They will call specifically for a CIT officer. And we have, you know, we try to saturate all the districts with it, and so we try to be available to go on these type of calls when they arise.
Lauren, your organization, Rediscover, you're now partnering with the Kansas City Police Department's crisis intervention team. Do I have that right? And how is that working?
So for years, we've actually had that partnership, what, since 1991?
Yeah.
So we've actually had a very long partnership with them. I think we've enhanced our partnership since we have added the Kansas City Assessment and Triage Center. We've added a CIT support position for them, and we have what's called a community mental health liaison. So that's not unique just to Rediscover. They're actually spread out through the state, and that's almost like a co-responder for that police officer. So they really are targeting any of the CIT calls coming in, any of those referrals, and they're basically both going into the community to see that person at their home, under the bridge, wherever that person might be, and tag teaming in an effort to really provide provide a supportive opportunity for that person to get better.
Now, when Rediscover intervenes, you can work with someone for what, 24 hours?
So that's just at the KCATC. We have long-term services as well.
I see.
So we have the whole gamut of services. If someone needs years and years and years of support, we have that option. We have the more short-term, if they need 30, 60, 90 days, if they need ongoing medication services.
Right.
So we have the full array. If they need substance use services, we have residential treatment. So we're really not a one-stop shop because we don't have the primary care aspect, but we have all of the behavioral health services.
Sergeant, was this new sensitivity towards the mentally ill, was it too long in coming?
Yeah, I think it has been. And I think, you know, before this, I mean, I guess there's some good things that have come out of it, the training, is that we've also been able to look at officer wellness in the same aspect, you know, that we want to have a good career, a long career, and that some of the secondary trauma and trauma-informed care that goes along with the training and CIT and working with Rediscover and the other community health centers has kind of focused on, you know, we need to take care of ourselves, our families, and be more aware of, you know, what's going on with us. And that's kind of been a secondary, unintentional byproduct, but it's been a good one as well, too. We see officers that aren't afraid to ask for a little help for their families and their own self. And we've seen a reduction in our suicide rate. We've had a pretty abysmal suicide rate in law enforcement. And since CIT has been around in the Kansas City area, we've seen a definite reduction in that.
That's interesting. We'll have to leave our conversation there. That was the voice of Sergeant Sean Hess, a 27-year member of the Kansas City Police Department. He helped create the crisis intervention team. Lauren Moyer was also here. She's with Rediscover, the nonprofit community mental health center that provides comprehensive help here. Thank you both for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks
very much.
Thank you.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske and follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow on the show, updates on the latest development and infrastructure projects in downtown Kansas City, including the first completely new church to be built downtown in more than a century. I just walked by it this morning. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.